This is Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour we'll revisit the series, Who's in Charge of the News? A lot of local newspapers have gone away, victims of changing technology and a funding structure that's collapsed. What are some solutions? We'll discuss that and more. Students are getting serious about climate change, so how are educators helping them? We'll take a look at the oldest hospital in Chicago, which has seen its share of tough times. We'll learn more about Mercy Hospital. And 30 years ago, an environmental protest in southern Illinois led to a temporary ban on harvesting trees in the Shawnee National Forest. A film profiles that event. Stay with us. Statewide is just ahead. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ford County lost a weekly newspaper this past year, joining more than 2,100 other American newspapers that have shut down since 2005. But another paper, launched just a year ago, still serves the East Central Illinois County, and it provides a test of whether residents of that rural Central Illinois County still want to pay for local journalism. Jim Meadows reports.
Dave Bohr is a lifelong resident of Paxton, Ford County's largest town and the county seat. He remembers the Ford County Record when it was the Paxton Record, a more prosperous newspaper that even published a daily edition.
The Paxton Record, they actually did a pretty good job through most of the time that I was there. Did a good job with local news. It was a good media to get local news and information.
But the Record, which ended its daily edition in 2007, has struggled to survive. As 2019 came to a close, the newspaper's new owners, Community Media Group, or CMG, laid off sports editor Andrew Rostin in a cost-cutting move. News editor Will Brumlevy left the paper too, and together they started their own weekly, the Ford County Chronicle, with seed money from Rostin's GoFundMe page and Brumlevy's brother, a software engineer. Brumlevy says he felt Rostin got a raw deal, and looking at the Record since he left, he doesn't think the new owners share his and Rostin's commitment to local coverage.
Both of us live in Paxton, and we were like, you know what, our community deserves the news. You know, we thought maybe we could make enough money on our website selling ads that we could at least make it worth our time, you know?
When you lay out their issues side by side, the CMG-owned Ford County Record tends to have the higher page count. But the new Ford County Chronicle has more news and sports coverage of Ford County, nearly all of it written by Brumlevy and Rostin. The Record's Ford County News is supplemented by out-of-town stories from its sister newspapers. Paul Barrett is the Ford County Record's publisher at CMG's Champaign Multimedia Group Division. He disclosed his company's intention to stop publishing the Record in a mid-September interview. He says the paper was already ailing when they acquired it along with the Champaign News Gazette in 2019. Barrett wishes the new Ford County Chronicle well and says he thinks small-town weeklies like it may do best with hands-on local owners.
If there is homegrown folks owning and running and dedicating their lives and their livelihood to those small-town newspapers, I think that's the best opportunity for survival rather than have big companies like us or the Gannettes of the world own these small little papers.
To make the Ford County Chronicle a success, Brumlevy and Rostin must win back former readers who have gotten out of the newspaper habit. That includes Dave Bohr, who says that after the Record ended its daily edition and changed owners, he found himself going increasingly online for news. Now he finds most of his news through Facebook, sent to him by friends or offered to him by the Facebook algorithm. Bohr isn't completely satisfied by what he gets.
I'm certain that there's things that are going on that I would be interested in that I have no idea is happening because it's algorithmed out, it's buried in a post that I didn't see, or I just scanned past it and it looked like something that would just be nothing but controversy and arguments.
Other challenges facing the new Ford County Chronicle, Ford County's declining population to less than 14,000 in the 2020 census, and Brumlevy and Rostin's lack of experience with the business side of newspapers. Brumlevy says that's led to costly mistakes, like a delay in getting a second-class postal permit. The Chronicle's most recent correction is an increase in its print subscription rate announced in mid-September, although reading the paper's website is still free. Brumlevy says the old rates didn't cover the cost of printing and mailing the newspaper. I'm Jim Meadows.
The term news desert describes an area with a shortage of news coverage. And according to research by Penelope Muse Abernathy, 28 Illinois counties have just one newspaper apiece. Two counties, Hamilton and Pulaski in southern Illinois, have none. For the series Who's in Charge of the News, Jim Meadows asked Abernathy if any of those areas are news deserts.
Well, I think that you can look at a place that has only one news outlet as a place that is at risk of becoming a news desert. And people in rural and outlying areas have suffered a double whammy. So if they lose the newspaper, that's one thing. But then the second part is that many of the state, regional, and metro papers that used to provide additional coverage of big trends for areas like southern Illinois, they have pulled back and downsized their reporting staff. Many of the metro papers and the state papers are what I would call ghost newspapers, in which they have much less than half of the reporting staff they used to have.
Now, there are several newspapers in downstate Illinois owned by chains such as Lee Enterprises and by the new Gannett, the former Gatehouse chain, CNHI, which owns the Danville Commercial News, and Community Newspaper Group, which owns the News Gazette, papers which have seen cutbacks in staff. Would you call any of these ghost newspapers?
Well, I think that we have to put it in larger context. The for-profit economic model that supported local newspapers for the past 200 years collapsed. But by the same token, we've had the emergence of these tech giants. So many people assumed if you could just get small newspapers to transition to digital, you could solve the for-profit problem. The problem has been that because the emergence of Facebook and Google specifically, and more Amazon, they siphon off as much as 75 to 80% of the digital dollars in that market. And unfortunately, without a kind of notion of how you're going to invest to serve your readers going forward, it often tends to be a death spiral.
These are companies who have acquired these newspapers. Do they see a future for what they're publishing?
We found that there are really three things that determine whether a newspaper can survive for the long term. You need a market that has decent prospects for growth. You need a publisher or owner who can respond to local needs and expectations of both residences and businesses. And you need to have the capital to invest.
When you raise these three things that you need for a successful local newspaper, when you look at these smaller markets in downstate Illinois, do you see that?
One of the things that our research has found, and that is most concerning to me, is that when an economically struggling community loses a news outlet, nothing replaces it. And these are so clearly the communities that need the kind of information that helps residents make wise decisions. And that requires us, I think, to think about policies at both the national level, at the state level, and again, at the local level. One of the things that's encouraging to me as a first step is the Local Journalism Sustainability Act that has bipartisan support in Congress. And it would do things that attempt to begin to address the issue. One, by giving a tax credit to anyone who subscribes to a news organization, by giving tax credits to the businesses that advertise in local newspapers, and then finally giving a tax credit to a news organization if it hires reporters to cover important special topic issues. The good news is we have an awareness, not just among the industry, but I think among politicians, understanding that our democracy depends on the free flow of information at the local level that it begins to inform policy at the grassroots level, then the state level, and then the national level.
That's Penelope Muse Abernathy, and she spoke with Jim Meadows about the problems facing local newspapers. Abernathy began her mapping of news deserts at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she's continuing her research as a visiting professor at Northwestern University. You can find a link to her news desert map and her 2020 report, News Deserts and Ghost Newspapers, Will Local News Survive? We have a link at our website. Just go to nprillinois.org. Look for Statewide. With newspapers on the decline in Illinois and elsewhere, you may be wondering where to get quality news about communities across the Midwest. Reginald Hardwick spoke with two people documenting the next generation of news outlets.
In June, students at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism published articles and videos called How Creative Thinkers Are Reinventing Local News in the Midwest. And we're now joined by two people connected to that project. Professor Craig Duff leads Medill's graduate journalism video and broadcast specialization. And Melody Hoffman-Guernsey is one of Duff's former students who fanned out across the Midwest to learn about these news outlets. And I say former student because she graduated and is now a TV reporter in Wisconsin. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Craig, why was it important to do profiles on these news outlets throughout the Midwest?
A couple of years ago, the newspaper near my hometown, the newspaper I grew up with, the Youngstown Vindicator, went out of business after 150 years. And what I saw happen there was a lot of folks wanted to shore up the reporting. They understood what happens when a newspaper goes away, and they wanted to find ways to keep the reporting going. And a couple of them were pretty innovative ways of doing it. One was a digital outlet that sort of what started there, that was funded by Google to start a new digital site. And so when it came time to do a project with my students, I thought about this documentary that I had done about that called Newstown. And why don't we try to see if there are other places around the Midwest that were within driving distance for our students to go to that are doing similar things to shore up reporting in local areas.
Melody, tell us about the news outlet that you focused on.
We focused on Black Iowa News, and we were appreciative to be able to follow around Dana James, who created that outlet.
Let's take a listen to an excerpt from that story.
On one of the first warm spring days in Des Moines, Iowa, Dana James meets a group of young activists at the Evelyn K. Davis Park.
I feel like the worst part about being arrested is like it's essentially like almost this crucifixion you go through where they like drag you through the mud.
James is trying to connect Iowa's vibrant Black history with the modern movement for Black empowerment. She says the Black community in Iowa, including these young activists that she's covering, are often poorly represented or overlooked by mainstream media.
They're real people, they're human beings. They're not just this story for you to roll up with your camera and then you roll out, but you don't really care about the community. You don't really care about the effect of, you know, putting someone's mugshot all over the place.
What was it like trying to follow a journalist who's trying to cover an entire state?
It was very exciting. It was one thing if it was just audio, but trying to get video, I mean, it was hard to keep up with her. She really knows a lot of people, and just as a journalist really wanted to get to the root of so many stories and people and characters.
And Reginald, I would say that, you know, what's unique about this story is that this is an individual person who took this upon herself because she didn't think that the main media was addressing things in the way that she felt were important to the population that she's reaching out to. And she was able to use an innovative approach by using Substack and creating a newsletter format that can reach people. And so that was, you know, that was the focus of the innovation in that particular story.
Another newsroom that you featured is here in Central Illinois. Here's an excerpt of a story on the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting based in Champaign.
When COVID-19 swept across America, many workers were considered essential, particularly in the food industry. And at meatpacking plants across the Midwest, the labor force was hit particularly hard by the disease. Since April of 2020, more than 50,000 cases have been tied to the meatpacking industry, including dozens at this plant in Rantoul, Illinois. Sky Chad is the managing editor at the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Its reporters followed the story as the virus swept through the industry, an industry that was slow to implement safety measures.
Part of that was workers are just kind of really like shoved close together in these plants, like shoulder to shoulder. And that just makes things much more efficient for the companies, like the closer they are squeezed together. the more meat they can push out.
This is a story that might have gone unreported if there wasn't an investigative watchdog holding people accountable in the rural and agricultural areas of the country. That's the mission of the Midwest Center in Champaign, Illinois.
Melody, as a journalist who is early in your career, what did participating in this project teach you about the state of journalism today?
It really showed me that it was needed. I feel like as you go through journalism school and you talk to your professors and you do your homework and you read news, you can a lot of times get jaded by where news is coming from and what other people think of how news is presented. But I felt like this project showed that one person can make a difference, and a story is a story, and stories still need to be told. It doesn't matter what platform.
You know, within the last year here in Central Illinois, we've lost two newspapers, the Rantoul Press and Ford County Record, both papers dated back to the 1870s. Craig, I know you had a documentary called Newstown and that we are featuring on WILL TV on Thursday evening. What is that documentary about? How did it come about?
Well, the Youngstown Vindicator was a newspaper that came out around in the 19th century as well. It was 150 years old when it announced that it would close down in 2019. And the people in the community in Youngstown and the area around it, the Mahoning Valley, were quite shocked to hear that it was happening, but it had been struggling for a number of years and losing money for a long time. And what happens when a newspaper goes away is a number of impacts. Everything from, you know, your source of history, you know, the library where the newspaper sits on microfilm, is the history of a community. And that when that goes away, you lose a lot. You know, luckily for Youngstown, there were a lot of other organizations there that could step in. In fact, the paper I used to deliver when I was a kid, the Warren Tribune Chronicle, ended up buying the name of the Vindicator and the subscriber list, and is now publishing a Vindicator edition to the former subscribers of the Vindicator. So all was not lost. A lot of reporters were lost. There were maybe 45 or so reporters and editors who were laid off when the newspaper went away, and they've not been replaced.
We've been talking with Professor Craig Duff, who leads Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, Graduate Journalism Video and Broadcast Specialization, and Melody Hoffman-Grunzi, a former student, now TV reporter in Madison, Wisconsin, who helped profile the next generation of news outlets across the Midwest. Melody and Craig, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Reginald Hardwick, Illinois Newsroom.
We have more to come on Statewide. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. When the COVID-19 vaccine first began rolling out, white evangelicals and Republicans were among the groups most likely to say they were not interested in getting vaccinated. And now, as mandates have become more common, so has the pushback based on religion and politics. To learn more about the political and religious factors underlying these trends, Brian Moline spoke with Ryan Burge. He's an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University and a pastor in the American Baptist Church. Burge says his research shows political affiliation has become a bigger part of the identity of white evangelicals, even more than their faith.
So what that means is that religion is not as important in the lives of the average American, I think, as a lot of pastors would want you to believe, or even as many social scientists believed 10 or 15 years ago. Now it's sort of like politics has become a type of religion and created a religious worldview for people. So now what we're seeing more and more is people are actually picking what church they go to based on the political affiliations of the members of that church and the kind of messaging they hear at that church. They're much more likely to change their church than they are to change their politics. And it's pretty easy just to uproot and go to a new church down the road if it's more conservative or more liberal and you like that. You'll just uproot yourself and go to a new place. And pastors have sort of lost their influencer status, I guess to use a 21st century word, in the lives of many Americans. I've had many pastors tell me, listen, I get them for 30 minutes once a week if they pay attention, and a lot of them don't. They get Tucker Carlson or Rachel Maddow for an hour every night, five nights a week, you know, for 52 weeks a year. So there's no way that I can have the same impact on their worldview as cable news can have on their worldview and social media can have on their worldview. So for many pastors, they've sort of given up the fight for politics and have walked away from it entirely.
You know, when COVID-19 vaccines first began rolling out, polls found that both Republicans and white evangelical Christians were among the groups most likely to say they would not be getting vaccinated. And I'm curious if that surprised you at all.
No, because we know that white evangelicals were typically Republicans. We know that the pandemic became partisan, right? Everything about the pandemic became partisan. It wasn't just about public health. It was about control, big government versus small government, individual freedom versus community health. But the other thing is, when you think about the lockdowns, what they did was they told churches they can't operate. They can't meet together. And so for a lot of Christians, that throws off all kinds of red flags because they're always worried the government is going to try to usurp the power of religion in American life. That's something that evangelicals talk about all the time. Even 5, 10, 20 years ago, it was the government's trying to intrude upon your liberty to worship freely. And so when it happened and when churches closed down, a lot of people said, this is the playbook. This is the government trying to take your rights away and take your freedom of religion away. This is all being orchestrated to make the church weaker and make the government stronger. So you should resist that because this is the moment that we've been preparing for. This is the moment we've been worrying about, and it's actually come to pass. So it didn't take on a public health tone for a lot of Republicans, white evangelical Republicans. It took on a conspiratorial tone that the government's really coming to try to take your worship, your right to worship away from you. Don't let them have it. Fight back. So I think a lot of that was all tied up in this conspiratorial thinking and this persecution complex that a lot of white evangelicals have. And the government, with the mandates and the lockdowns, basically played into that mentality.
Interesting. You know, as time has gone along, vaccine hesitancy has declined among faith groups overall. The decline has been less pronounced among white evangelicals compared to some other religious affiliations. And I'm curious, have you seen any evidence to suggest that appeals to a person's faith, for example, calling on Christians to get the vaccine out of love for their neighbors. Is there any evidence you've seen that those types of appeals are working?
There's some evidence on the margin that they do help, but on the margin, I mean, increasing vaccination rates by 1-3%. There's not any sort of, you know, silver bullet you can use when it comes to religion to get people over that hump and take them from absolutely not to actually getting, you know, both shots of a vaccine. More often than not, for a lot of these faith groups, it's logistics stuff they've helped with. Things like having a vaccination clinic in the church or providing transportation to a vaccination clinic in the community is what's helping a lot of these people get vaccinated. So it's not necessarily a theological or spiritual appeal. It's a logistical challenge they're helping them overcome. White evangelical pastors are in this terrible position because many of them are pro-vaccine and want to get vaccinated and want their congregation to get vaccinated. But what they know is that there's a significant portion of their congregation that will not, under any circumstances, get the vaccine. And if the pastor pushes that, they're going to get blowback. They're going to get, you know, they might lose their job over something like that. Because pastors in the evangelical tradition serve at the pleasure of their congregation. If they make them mad, they can be fired without any legal recourse. So when you know that your congregation is divided on an issue, you are less likely to speak out on that issue because you're in such a precarious position being the leader of this congregation. So what you do is just you remain silent. And when you remain silent, something else is going to fill that void in the lives of your congregation. And like we talked about, I think a lot of times social media and cable news fill that gap and give you information that might not always be the most Christian perspective on things, but also might not be the most accurate, you know, just scientifically accurate information. But in a lot of ways, evangelical pastors are caught between a rock and a hard place. Speak up and make people mad, but maybe increase vaccination rates, be quiet and keep your job, but also maybe do a few more funerals for people who got COVID-19 and died from it because they did not get the vaccination because you did not encourage them to do so. That's a hard thing to figure out what to do.
You know, there are some evangelical leaders like Franklin Graham, for example, son of the late Billy Graham, who have openly encouraged Christians to get the vaccine. You know, is there a way for evangelical pastors to do that without alienating a sizable portion of their congregation?
I think the best approach would be to say, I got vaccinated and here's why. Not telling people what they should do, right? Not forcing people or mandating people. I don't think houses of worship should get in the business of mandating vaccines. I think it's just a bad idea for a whole bunch of reasons, but I think they need to speak into that void being left by the silence that they've had for the last 6 months, right? They've not been talking about vaccines for 6 months. What you can say is, I got vaccinated and here's why. I'm immunocompromised. My parents are immunocompromised. My son or daughter had cancer and I'm worried about them. I don't want to bury members of my congregation dying from COVID-19 unnecessarily, right? You can start talking about the science in the most objective and neutral way, but I also think messaging, maybe not necessarily talking about COVID-19 and the vaccine specifically, but talking about what it means to be a good citizen, neighbor, a good part of your community, what it means to love people you don't know, and what it means to be a Christian in a world where people are looking for kindness, right? And so whenever I talk to my congregation as a pastor, I would say you should wear a mask. Am I convinced that it will make sure that you don't get COVID? No. But what it does is it's an act of kindness for people that you come in contact with, saying, I care about you, even though I don't know you, and I care about your well-being, even though I don't know about your well-being.
That's Eastern Illinois University Professor Ryan Burge, who's also a pastor in the American Baptist Church, and he spoke with Brian Moline. Students don't see climate change as a future threat anymore. They look at raging wildfires, massive power outages, and heavy storms, and they see a crisis today. Peter Medlin with WNIJ reports on what Illinois environmental educators are doing to help their students meet the moment.
Many companies are hesitant to switch over to clean energy because they see it potentially harming profits or causing job loss. What can you tell us about the benefits of large companies switching to carbon-free energy practices from both a climate change and economic standpoint?
Seventh grader Bryn O'Hare posed that question to a panel of experts during the 2021 Kids Climate Summit set up by the Chicago Gifted Community Center. It's a question many Illinois leaders have considered, especially after the state passed a sweeping clean energy bill this year. Other kids in the climate summit asked about climate change's effect on food systems and animals, but their worries could be boiled down to one from a Chicago middle schooler.
My major concern about climate change is that there isn't being enough done by those in power.
Students leading climate advocacy isn't new, especially since Swedish activist teen Greta Thunberg's School Strikes for Climate. In Illinois, other student-led initiatives are at the forefront of environmental education conversations. Maya Strachnik is a recent Elgin High School graduate who helped organize the latest National Biodiversity Teach-In. It's a series of webinars hosted by Elgin that brings in scientists and researchers from across the globe to remotely present to students. She booked guests, led public relations, and helped handle tech for the event. And she says it was the best and only example she had in high school of how active a role students should have in their own education.
You are the reason that they're there. You're giving other students the opportunity to get involved with them. And I think that was something that I wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
The biodiversity event started thanks to the story of the last passenger pigeon. Elgin science teacher and Teach-In co-founder Deb McMullen told it often because it's a prime example of how factors like habitat loss and invasive species can lead to extinction.
They were just like, what? There were that many birds and they were just gone in 40 years?
A project about that final pigeon, Martha, snowballed into the international multi-day environmental science teach-in that Elgin's been running since 2014. That was around the same time Illinois adopted the Next Generation Science Standards. McMullen says support from the standards allowed them to curate student-centered curriculum. Some teachers think environmental education still deserves more attention. Samantha Scanlon teaches at Plainfield South High School. Over the past 5 years, she says student interest in environmental science issues has been at an all-time high. They don't even have to leave Illinois to illustrate environmental issues anymore. They can point to fallout from the Chemtool fire or an E. coli scare that closed their school for a day this fall. But Scanlon laments that many schools don't require environmental science for graduation.
They kind of just shoved them into classes where they don't even necessarily make sense sometimes. It's definitely not a priority curriculum-wise, which is I would have hoped by now after 20 years.
Abby Yenlin, the executive director of the Environmental Education Association of Illinois, agrees. Her organization is helping develop national standards and offers training and programs for Illinois teachers. They also just rewrote their environmental literacy framework for the first time in a decade, focusing on equity. Now, environmental literacy isn't just about understanding the environment, but building relationships. It's about seeing that everything is interrelated and that humans are a part of the natural world, not over it. Enlin says the old standards were outdated and asked all schools to do things the same way.
It's all changed drastically in the past few years. We now understand that not only is this not feasible, but it's not equitable either. Communities aren't built the same.
The new tenets of environmental literacy explore concepts like environmental justice and civic action. Environmental issues like climate change can feel overwhelming and too big for any one student to tackle. Educators still teach that there is hope, though. They say students can make a difference, but to preserve their future, action from those in power is still more than crucial. I'm Peter Mudlin.
Officials with the Galesburg Public Library have been dreaming for decades about constructing a new library building, and now with some help from the city and the state, that dream is on the verge of coming true. Jane Carlson has more.
Galesburg once had a Carnegie Library. It was built in 1902, but destroyed by fire in May of 1958. A few years later, in 1961, the library reopened in what was meant to be a temporary building at the original site on East Simmons Street.
And here we are 60 years later, still in that temporary building.
That's Library Director Noelle Thompson. She says the new library will solve the practical problems of the current building, such as inadequate space for materials and youth activities, lack of office space and private study rooms, insufficient parking and accessibility concerns. But it's also about valuing knowledge and the opportunities and empowerment that come with access to that knowledge.
All of those values are so strong in a public library, and we believe more than ever we need those in our community today. And so investing in a new building is really about investing in our community and in the well-being of the people who live around us.
The new library will take up the entire 200 block of West Main Street in downtown Galesburg. Properties at that site have already been purchased and demolished. The library staff and board first hired a building consultant for a potential new library in 2007, but Thompson says it was a vision for the community long before that. She says over time, the library will be able to grow its holdings by 30,000 items in the new 68,000 square foot building.
Right now, we have about 140,000 items on our shelves. So it's over a 20% increase to be able to grow in the new building.
The facility will also include ample parking and community rooms, green spaces, and an expanded children's area. 75% of construction costs are being funded by a more than $15 million grant from the Illinois State Library. Thompson says the grant is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Galesburg.
We also want to stress that the Galesburg Public Library belongs to everybody. So we want everybody involved in this project and to communicate, you know, any vision that they have for the new building. We want to be able to incorporate that.
The remaining funds are being raised through a capital campaign and some help from the city. This week, the Galesburg City Council voted to transfer $775,000 from the city's general fund to the library. Combined with $1.3 million already raised, the library is now more than halfway to its nearly $4 million goal. Thompson says the money from the city will cover technology costs. That includes networking, software, and equipment. The new library will have a skills lab, more computers for patron use and checkout, and setups for remote work and conferencing needs. And the entire city block at the library site will be wired for high-speed internet access for public use. Thompson says the technology will help ensure all members of the community have the digital access and digital literacy skills essential to securing employment and basic needs.
Whether that's scheduling an appointment to get a vaccine, communicating with our doctors and following up with our doctors, filing for unemployment, filing our taxes, all of those essential requirements just from our day-to-day lives require internet access, but then also the ability to use computers or other devices.
A library construction bid was awarded last month. Weather permitting, there could be some activity at the site through the winter months. Construction will begin in earnest in the spring, with Galesburg's new public library expected to be ready for patrons by the end of 2023. I'm Jane Carlson.
Eureka College is not giving up on its long-running quest to bring a statue of President Ronald Reagan to the Illinois Capitol grounds. President Dr. Jamel Wright says she's not heard any updates since a cohort of Eureka College officials testified before a State House committee in September, but she remains optimistic. Wright says the statue would depict a young Ronald Reagan as he appeared while attending Eureka College back in the 1930s.
There's not been that many presidents, of course, in our country, in our great country. And to have one of them born, raised, and educated in our great state of Illinois, that's important and significant and something that we should, you know, in some way pay homage to.
Reagan is the only U.S. president who was born in the state of Illinois. Stay right here, more of Statewide to come. You're listening to Statewide Just Ahead. We'll tell you about a film that tells the story of an environmental protest in Southern Illinois 30 years ago. Up next, Mercy Hospital, the oldest hospital in Chicago, was a safety net facility treating mostly low-income, elderly, and black patients. It was hemorrhaging money and staff and eventually closed this year until getting rescued in the 11th hour. Kristen Schorsch of WBEZ spent a year documenting what happened to Mercy, and here's an excerpt of her series.
What's this? That's my gin and tonic.
It's Memorial Day, close to midnight, and the scene in the parking lot of Chicago's historic Mercy Hospital is like a tailgate party. Music is blaring. There's a table heavy with food, drinks all around.
I think it's just pink lemonade.
Dr. Adele Cobbs, who helped lead Mercy's ER, takes a sip.
No, it's not. Just pink lemonade.
Stiff drinks aside, this isn't just any tailgate. It's more of a wake or a celebration of life. A toast to Mercy, Chicago's oldest chartered hospital. In the crowd are nurses, doctors, technicians. It's a family, and they've come to say goodbye. Because within the hour, a new owner takes over, and Cobbs and hundreds of other employees are not sticking around.
It just wasn't going to be Mercy. There was no signs of mercy in this plan. So, you know, Mercy's not a building. It's the people.
She points to the building where she grew up and says how much she's intertwined in this community, how Mercy is home. But just 30 minutes after we spoke, that would change for good. This is the story of how Mercy disappeared. In July of last year, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, Mercy's leaders delivered a jolt. The hospital would close in 2021. Ultimately, it would get bought in the 11th hour. But until then, Mercy would slowly fade away as the community it served battled to save it.
All we hear every day is people doing press conferences where Black Lives Matter is coming out of their mouth. When it counts, our lives really don't matter.
As a so-called safety net hospital, Mercy treated mostly poor, elderly, and black patients in an area where health disparities raged.
As an OB that's serving the community, I see the lack of care for these patients.
Today's story is about more than just a hospital going under. It's a window into why healthcare is so unequal, into the struggle to provide treatment to the people who need it most.
Unless we change the underlying medical system in this country, these hospitals cannot survive, because we set up a structure that makes it impossible.
Mercy has a rich legacy. It was about 170 years old and survived the Great Chicago Fire. It trained generations of doctors and treated lots of famous patients, from Teddy Roosevelt to Muhammad Ali. And so many people who work there say it was a special place. Dr. John Patterson was an OBGYN who spent 45 years at Mercy.
And back then, you know, everybody, it was like a big family, really. Everybody would have a wonderful party. So, you know, you got a chance to know everybody in the hospital.
It's where Patterson met his wife. Many employees have these deep connections. Mercy is where they were born. It's where they and their own families and friends go when they get sick. Dr. Alan Jackson was a cardiologist at Mercy who grew up across the street, skateboarding in the shadow of the hospital as a kid.
I mean, I might have a guy from Streets and Sands, Bridgeporter, who may be related to one of the politicians. I may have someone from Chinatown that speaks a dialect called Tai Chinese, which is rare. We have nurses who can speak that. We have Latino patients, and then we have our black population. So you just see a slice of real Chicago at Mercy.
But here's another reality. The South Side is a healthcare desert, where people have dramatically less access to care than in whiter, richer parts of Chicago. There's a severe drought of physicians, even though people who live here tend to get sicker and die younger. So Mercy was an oasis, but safety nets like it are bleeding money. They're losing patients. And the ones who do show up often have no insurance, or the insurance they do have doesn't nearly cover the cost to treat them. That puts these hospitals in the worst position to provide care to the most vulnerable people. You can hear how frustrating this is to those who've worked there. like John Patterson.
The reason that there's a problem with safety nets is because the people that live in the safety nets, you know. The problem is that with black and brown people are not valued. Our lives are not valued.
And when safety nets cut services or close, the people left behind feel abandoned, like these hospitals just didn't try hard enough.
I actually thought I was going to die, and I owe my life to Mercy Hospital. If they close Mercy, then where would I be?
92-year-old Dolores Wilson lives less than a mile from the hospital. She was treated there last spring when her intestines became inflamed. When the pain came back a few weeks later, she called an ambulance.
And I said, well, just take me to Mercy. They said, we can't take you to Mercy. I said, but I was at Mercy before. They said, we cannot take you to Mercy. They're closed or whatever. I said, no, they're not. I was there just a few weeks ago.
Mercy's ER was so short of nurses that paramedics for months had been taking patients to other hospitals. That created a domino effect. Wilson says she waited 14 hours in another hospital's packed ER. Finally, she got frustrated and left without ever seeing a doctor. Mercy turned down all of our interview requests, so we spent some time in another Southside Safety Net hospital, one that's wrestling with the same issues.
I'm Yolanda Penny. I'm the director of nursing here at St. Bernard's. I've been here 29 years.
It's mid-July, and Penny is showing me around. St. Bernard is in Englewood, about 5 miles south of Mercy.
Okay, we're going to go to the emergency room. Oh, Mr. Holland's there. Please be patient with us. We're doing a little reconstruction in our ED.
The emergency department is like a hospital's front door, but over the sound of construction, Penny tells me she doesn't have nearly enough nurses to work it.
So I'll give you an example. Tonight I'm challenged. I have 4 nurses scheduled. I should have 9.
When the pandemic hit last year, many nurses left for private agencies that paid in some cases 6 times more than St. Bernard.
It's sometimes debilitating where there are those of us who come in and help work just to make sure they can get through the day.
I catch up with Penny later. She says overnight the ER was full. There was a patient who was shot multiple times, a sick baby, a woman who said she'd already been to 3 other ERs, and 2 of them were so slammed people were waiting outside in lawn chairs. So Penny, the director of nursing, scrubbed up and went to work as an ER nurse.
We as Safety Net Hospitals are here to serve as a community, to make sure that they stay safe. But as far as resources, we do not have those.
The struggles have been much the same at Mercy. And last year, leaders there said they had reached a breaking point. The hospital was losing at least $4 million a month. Mercy's owners tried, but failed, to save the hospital with a $1 billion merger. So in July of 2020, they announced the hospital would close this year. There was immediate outrage. What would happen to patients if this oasis in this healthcare desert disappeared? Here's Dr. John Patterson again.
So basically, you're releasing these patients and you really don't have any place for them to land. It's like pushing them out of a plane without a parachute.
Over the next several months, it would be a long fall. I'm Kristen Schorsch in Chicago.
A film by a professor at SIU Carbondale tells the story about an environmental protest from the early 1990s. It led to a temporary ban on harvesting trees from the Shawnee National Forest at a site near Murfreesboro. Kevin Boucher explains.
The new film is called Shawnee Showdown, Keep the Forest Standing. It's a new documentary from filmmaker Cade Burcell. Burcell is also professor of cinema at the School of Media Arts at SIUC. And using archival footage and new interviews, her new film tells the story of how environmentalists held a nearly 80-day blockade and protest in the summer of 1990 to stop the United States Forest Service from harvesting trees in the Fairview area near the Little Grand Canyon near Murfreesboro in Jackson County. Media coverage at the time showed the passion of the protesters, with photographs of 3 protesters who had buried themselves up to their waist at the site, and activists who literally chained themselves to heavy equipment, including a bulldozer.
The group of people who are in the film, you know, they protested in the 90s. They lost
the battle with at six sites. There were six sites that were logged. But they eventually won in court, and that's what's such an interesting story, is that they were successful. They were activists who engaged in direct action, like what you described, chaining themselves, you know, to the trucks and, you know, things like that, the gates. But they also pursued this legal course of action, and eventually a lawyer came on board, Tom Buschel, and he came on. Until then, they had been doing all this research themselves and were going to court pro se, which is really remarkable. They spent a lot of time in legal libraries and, you know, trying to figure out this court system.
And when the activists were not in the library, they were camping out on the Forest Service land, literally blocking the path of the loggers. Jan Wilder was there protesting in 1991 and remembers it vividly.
Yeah, chaining. John got chained, and they had to use bolt cutters, I think a welding tool to weld him off of his chains. I mean, we did everything. He did that action on his birthday. So he got arrested on his birthday.
Another tactic was used.
So we staged a hunger strike. So for 3 weeks, I didn't eat food. And then I flew to D.C. while I was on my hunger strike.
In making the film, since Facebook and social media were not available back in the early 1990s, Burcell just couldn't log on to a website and download audio and video to make the film.
That's kind of a funny story, because it turns out that several of the activists had videotaped the news footage off the television, and they produced bags of VHS tapes, and those tapes had mold on them. So I had to try to see the tapes and then figure out which ones I needed to send out to be cleaned. And so some of the footage, when you see the film, you know, the footage has deteriorated, but it is such good footage. And when I had called the news stations, they didn't really have access to this footage any longer. I mean, it's 30 years.
That was my
point. And they didn't know where it was. And
sure.
So through fair use, I have, and cleaning this footage, I've been able to save some of this important history. And I'm really happy for that. And then we made DVDs for folks, and when I returned the VHS tapes to them.
Another protester featured in the film is Sam Stearns, who lives near Bell Smith Springs, deep in the Shawnee National Forest in southeastern Illinois. And in this new documentary, Stearns' passion for the forest comes through.
I'm a longtime lover of the Shawnee National Forest.
I asked Stearns, wasn't he afraid that he would lose his job over protesting the timber harvest in the Shawnee?
Well, the forest was more important to me than my job. At two different places of employment, I had people show up at my job and tried to get me fired based on my forest activism. In both cases, my employers backed me up.
And fellow activist Jan Wilder says as the years have gone by, she has slowed down a bit, but a phone call from filmmaker Cade Burcell lit the fire again.
Cade Burcell called me and said, would you like to interview? And she put together this documentary, like a miracle documentary, documenting the history of our struggle to save the Shawnee. And when she sent me the first draft, I watched it. My son was here. And it just brought everything back to the forefront of my mind and my heart.
That's Southern Illinois environmental activist Jan Wilder, who was among the protesters in the early 1990s seeking to stop the U.S. Forest Service from cutting down trees in the Fairview area of the Shawnee National Forest near Murfreesboro. Wilder is one of several activists seen in the new documentary film called Shawnee Showdown, Keep the Forest Standing. The film is by Cade Burcell, a professor of cinema at the School of Media Arts at SIU Carbondale. I'm Kevin Boucher.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being with us. A reminder, you can find our podcast. It's available through the NPR One app. And all of our episodes, you can find those at our website at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.